Welcome to the Metaphysical Martini Show, where wit and wisdom come together to bridge the gap between the spirit realm and the physical world. With Ani Avedisian, the Suburban Shaman, a production of Cosmic Reality Radio. And you're alive.
Hello, everyone. I'm Ani Avedisian. Welcome to Metaphysical Martini. Three parts spirit, one part rational mind. Add two drops of optimism. Give it all a good hard shake and pour. Dress it with the olives of grace and empathy. Sit back, sip slowly, and contemplate the wonder of cosmic creation. And a hearty hello to everyone out there. Hello, hello, hello. Welcome back. Thanks for joining us for yet another round of cosmic cocktails on this week's version of Metaphysical Martini, the show that tries to sort out what's true, what's woo, and what gets flushed down the loo in today's rapidly changing, highly strung little world. And as always, we try to do this with as much objectivity, grace, and empathy as we can muster on any given day, which hopefully is a lot, because objectivity, grace, and empathy are needed in spades, in veritable shovel loads of virtue, I would say. Our rally cry is, awaken, O my people! Do not follow the path of the sheeple, and do not give your God cause to weeple. Everyone deserves to be heard. Everyone has the right to present their point of view. The purpose of debate is progress, not distress. We're here on this planet to explore new ideas, to exchange ideas, to ask the hard questions, to discuss difficult and sensitive topics with maturity and a genuine desire to better our collective life experience. What we do instead, I think, is run around like a gaggle of oversugared toddlers, screaming our fool heads off, calling each other names, and demanding that everyone play by our set of rules. Soul sovereign beings do not engage in such immature activities. Critical thinkers do not resort to slander. They refine their arguments. Those who wish to live in harmony know that harmony must first come from within. And it is true that ultimately, the way we treat others is very much a reflection of how we feel about ourselves. Yes, sometimes we are tempted to bash people over the head with a soggy dish towel, but we must refrain from engaging in such childish behavior, no matter how satisfying it may be, because we are adults. And yes, some believe adulthood is vastly overrated, but here we are, so let's get on with it, I suppose. A little self-evaluation just once in a while goes a long, long way. How can we be honest with others if we can't be honest with ourselves? And honestly, it's not that difficult. It's just that we've forgotten to make it a habit. We accumulate a great deal of internalized, unprocessed emotions. And that, my darlings, is not a good thing. It's not a good thing because it turns our energy anatomy, which is a glorious field of cosmic connection, into a prison, an illusionary prison. We all say we want freedom, whatever that means. Yet we work diligently, day in, day out, to create these electrical prisons filled with minefields of emotional triggers. And as soon as someone treads on one, kaboom, we crash and we re-internalize. We all say we want to be free. We want life to be an adventure. But most of us don't even have the guts to ask for a pay raise or extra vacation time. So what does freedom mean to anyone? I could ask 10 people, I'll get 10 different answers. What exactly do we want to break free from? taxes, a relationship, an addiction, the man? Or is freedom just a vague idea that pops into our heads when we feel dissatisfied? So that's what we have to sort out first, I think. Well, to me, today at least, freedom means that in any shape or form, as long as I hurt no other living being and cause no harm to my host planet, I can do whatever the heck I please. And that sounds lovely, doesn't it? But you know the problem with that? That level of freedom requires something most of this population gave up a while ago, a moral compass and a sense of responsibility, something all cosmic space adventurers need. We need that sense of responsibility, the ability to react responsibly and appropriately to any situation we find ourselves in. We need honor, ethics, integrity, empathy, a reverence for all things, knowing that all of us are manifestations of source energy. And with all that, we need a jolly good sense of humor to make it work, because that's the glue. And in a world where the lines are blurred to the point of giving us all vertigo, that takes quite a bit of courage. To do the right thing takes courage. In an environment where free thinkers are ridiculed by indoctrinated conformists, it takes guts to step forward and present independent research. Heck, we risk ridicule just by asking a simple question, by daring to question the mainstream narrative on whatever. Do you have guts, my darlings? I know you do. I have guts. I work on it. I say, look, if something doesn't sit quite right with you, look into it. Poke around a bit. See what comes up. Ask questions. The truth doesn't need protection. It needs exposure. Poke around a bit, and you might find out just who's guarding the truth and who's writing an alternative version of events. Now, I say take heart. Let's be excited, because all this craziness that we're experiencing, it's part of the Great Awakening. It's part of the great grand illumination. The light is pouring into our realms, so let everyone be heard. And you know what's wonderful about all this light? Light exposes everything, doesn't it? If we talk rubbish, we'll know it's rubbish, and so will everyone else. I believe in freedom of speech. For obvious reasons, reasons associated to soul sovereignty, I do not wish to restrict another's language, or for that matter, seek to regulate their personal habits. How will we know what people are thinking, or think they are thinking, unless we allow them to express themselves freely? And that doesn't mean, however, that we are free from the consequences of our actions. You see, freedom requires, a moral compass and a sense of responsibility. Without those virtues, it's not so much an adventure as a free-for-all bloodbath. So let's talk. That's what this show's all about. I know pretty much I'm the one that's doing the talking, but it's really a little bit more interactive on an astral level. Let's talk. What's on your mind? Drop us a line. Let us know what you would like to chat about. Emails to arnie@arnieavedisian.com and snail mail to Cosmic Arnie, P.O. Box 714, Wilsonville, Oregon, 97070, USA, because that's where I pick up my mail. We devote a goodly portion of this show to Q&A, so, you know, rightly so. So don't be shy. Let's get right to it. Let me just say very quickly, thank you for all the emails telling us how much you enjoy the show and for your constructive criticism, constructive feedback on what you'd like to hear. I don't throw any of that away unless you're swearing at me, and some of you do, but most of you don't. So keep them coming, all very interested in what you have to say. So let's get right to the first question. Let me get a little sip of my drinky poo. Very lovely. First question comes from the UK. And it's Mandy. And Mandy says, "Dear Arnie, what do you think will happen when Queen Elizabeth II dies? Will it be the end of the monarchy? And how will that affect national stability?" Good question, because, you know, it's on everyone's mind. She's getting up there. I don't think that the monarchy will be dismantled, Mandy, because, you know, tourism. But I'm pretty sure it will change. So what is the monarchy really in England? What does it represent? Well, it's a constitutional monarchy. And for those who don't know, that's a form of government in which the king or the queen or whoever's acting as the monarch acts as the head of state within the parameters of a written constitution. And in a constitutional monarchy, the political power is shared between the monarch and a constitutionally organized government. And in England, that would be a parliament, where people sit on opposite sides of the chamber and yell at each other. That's what they do in the English parliament. They yell at each other and go, "Hear, hear, 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 shame, shame, order, order." Anyway, that aside, so constitutional monarchies, shared power. And England isn't the only one. I think there's, well, obviously Canada, because it's the same queen, but also Sweden and Japan. So it's a form of government in which a non-elected monarch functions as the head of state within the limits of a constitution. And the political power is shared between the monarch and the elected parliament. So you could say it's the sovereign reigns but does not rule the country. It's a more cooperative effort. So the monarchy, I guess, it's a living symbol of national unity, pride, tradition, all of that. And I don't think it's going to go away. Would it change and not become a constitutional monarchy if we disbanded that part of it? I mean, how much power does the Queen actually have? Because according to political, what are those people called? Political scientists, they reckon that the Queen has the right to be consulted, the right to encourage, and the right to warn. So the Prime Minister of Great Britain has to show up every week and chat with the Queen. And so if it's no longer a constitutional monarchy, I guess that goes away. He doesn't have to run stuff by her. And we have to ask ourselves, really, what true power does the monarchy have? You know, I think probably not that much anymore. And we're dismantling the globalist warmonger agenda step by step. And if we look at Japan's emperor, I'm not sure he actually has any role in government, does he? I mean, as far as I can tell, they just dress him up in a kimono and let him rip with the ceremonial duties every so often. Do we have any absolute monarchies left in the world? Well, there's Vatican City, if you think about it, and probably Brunei and Swaziland and Saudi Arabia and Oman. But I don't know that we have anything beyond that. So as far as the Queen's role as a leader in the establishment, which she is, well, the establishment are losing ground. And if they want to maintain any power, they're going to have to submit to the changes of the will of the people, and they're going to have to adapt. They don't like adapting. When you've been in power for thousands of years, you don't want to adapt. Diana was murdered. Sarah Ferguson left the family but did not spill the beans on Andrew's perversions. He did that himself later on. Harry does not want to be part of an institution that killed his mother. There are rumors, and they're just rumors right now, that the Queen will appoint Princess Anne as regent and bypass Charles and William. Both Charles and William are willing to make the necessary changes. And I suppose Her Majesty Elizabeth II feels Anne will keep it together for as long as she's able to. I'm not even sure that Anne would accept the regency. As for national stability, well, does the monarch stabilize the nation? I suppose that depends on the monarch and whose version of stability you buy into. We'll just have to wait and see. The royal aspect of it, it's not going to go away. It's too good for Britain. I mean, what else would be put on all the postcards if not the Queen and the royal family and, you know, all of the royal palaces and all the pretty little soldiers? When I say pretty little soldiers, please don't misunderstand me. They're real soldiers, but they're very well dressed, very handsomely dressed soldiers. So, you know, it's not going to go away. But will it affect the country? Look, we're going through some major changes here. I think the Queen's going to step back from having any meaningful role in government after she dies. So we will see. Well, obviously, she'll be dead. But whoever takes over from her is not going to have the same responsibilities. That's what I think. I thank you for the question. I'm sure it's on many people's minds, especially back home in the UK. And I wonder sometimes if the Queen will live forever. I have this vision of her just sitting with her royal derriere glued to the throne, staying there for eternity. I'm not leaving this chair. This is my position. I'm not going anywhere. I don't trust anyone else. So we'll see what happens. Thanks for the question. God save the Queen. Oh, there's another thing. Will they change the national anthem? I think they should do Rule Britannia. Much better song. Next question comes from Don't Use My Name, Please. Okay, I won't. Dear Arnie, what about those Boy Scouts, eh? What's your take on the latest? How long do you think this has been going on? Well, I think you're referring to the Boy Scouts of America filing Chapter 11 so they can regroup and settle lawsuits with the victims of sexual abuse. Because it seems there was a little, there was more than a little boy bobbing going along with all their dib-dib-dobbing, I would say. Shame, 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 naughty, naughty, naughty. So I believe the Boy Scouts of America are declaring bankruptcy so that they can save the organization. And it seems that they want to give people seeking compensation a very limited window of time to do so. And then they're going to bar everybody from acting against them. And what this does, I think it puts a lot of pressure on people who psychologically are not able to come forward. And they're saying you're going to have to come forward, otherwise you lose your chance. So as difficult as it is, I would say anybody who has a beef with the Boy Scouts, come forward sooner than later. The lawyers are going to, you know, make the most out of this because apparently I was speaking to one of my clients who's a paralegal, and she reckons this is honestly one of the most complex bankruptcies in history. It's not just one organization. You think, well, it's the Boy Scouts of America. They're suing them. But apparently there are many independently corporated Boy Scout councils and other bodies. So it's a bit of a legal nightmare. And I don't know anything about the legal stuff. But I guess the biggest nightmare is who actually takes the rap for the abuse and who shells out the money. As for how long the abuse has been going on, well, I mean, the Scouts are 110 years old. Well, the Scouts aren't. They're all very young. They're boys. But the organization is 110 years old. And meanwhile, I think over the last decade, I did a little bit of investigation, investigations, media reports, etc. They've revealed that through internal Boy Scout documents, they've detailed generations of alleged abusers. One investigator, just one that was hired by the Scouts, said last year that her team had identified 12,254 victims and 7,819 perpetrators in internal documents. And that's just from 1946 through 2016. So will they come out of this? How will they come out of this? I don't know. They're determined to come out of it. I did read that they have seen a 25% drop in membership in the last decade. That is huge. I think a major part of that is probably the Mormons. I believe there was a time where if you were a Mormon, you were also a Boy Scout. And then the Mormons started severing their ties with the Scouts when the Scouts started accepting gay Scout leaders. And it's estimated up to 20% of the membership of the Boy Scouts of America was Mormon. Latter-day Saints do not accept gays in leadership roles. I'm pretty sure gays do not accept Latter-day Saints in leadership roles either. So Scouts are in a bit of trouble, dropping membership, started accepting girls into their ranks to bolster their numbers, which, of course, did not go down well with the Girl Scouts of America, who then filed a lawsuit against the Boy Scouts for infringing copyright. You know, everyone's so, why are we so gender confused? Boy Scouts, boys. Girl Scouts, girls. If you're going to have both, then it's boys and girls. Anyway, so who knows what the Scouts are up to? Maybe they can take legal advice from the Catholic Church because no one knows more about abuse and how to hide it than they do. Apparently, the Scouts are pretty close to that. Not sure if they'll survive and rebuild. They're doing their best. It depends on how they're going to be led. You know, I remember it was about 8 years ago when I started, but when I realized that people were so deep in the slumber of brainwashing, and I despaired they might never wake up, I started talking about the Scouts, the Catholic Church, foster care, adoption agencies, and so forth, and my comments were not well received. Of course, no one wants their sleep time disturbed or their worldview disturbed, but I did say at that time that all organizations that failed to serve the light would be exposed and ultimately collapse under the weight of their own dysfunction, and that is happening. I also seem to remember that Boy Scouts of Great Britain were infiltrated by the Nazis in the 30s to the extent that it really caught the interest of military intelligence, MI6, SIS. That's the Foreign Intelligence Service of the UK, MI6. So all I have to say is shame on all the officers of all these organizations who knew there was a problem and did nothing about it. Shame on all who put their careers first before the welfare of others, those who could not advocate for themselves. Shame on all who systematically hid the abuse under piles of paperwork. Shame on all the parents who told their children it was all in their head. When we bring a child into this world, we are giving a manifestation of source, energy, and opportunity to experience life on earth. It is a sacred trust. Don't do it if you're not up for it. Shame, shame on all who abuse that trust. Thank you for your question. And here's another one. Dear Ani, you use the term soul sovereign or sovereign soul a lot. Would you define it, please? Also, you sometimes say supreme cosmic intelligence, sometimes source energy, sometimes creator, and sometimes God. Are they all the same or different? Please clarify. Well, thank you for listening enough to have caught all that. I will happily clarify, and I'll apologize because, you know, this is a transitionary time from the dark into the light, as it were. I'm trying to change the language, but it's probably going to be the generation after me that's going to come up with the best language. So I use a lot of terms interchangeably. But a sovereign soul is one who understands that it is an individualized manifestation of source energy with all the benefits and features that go along with it. And as such, the sovereign soul has the right to determine its own destiny. It is the intrinsic right of an individual to self-determination. It means we are created in source energy's wavelength and therefore have the same abilities of co-creation as source energy. Clearly, we're not created in anything's image because there was no image until we became physical. Supreme cosmic intelligence, creator, and source are the same in my book. But God is not. God is the commander, co-creator in chief of a universe. There is one source from which all life comes. There are many gods because there are many universes. But don't let that confuse you when you pray, because the divine celestial switchboard knows exactly where to send your prayers. You can use the term God, source, creator, unconditional. It doesn't matter. It's all the same. Where your heart pours out the love, that's where it will go. And unless you're really studying metaphysics in some detail, the difference isn't really that important. All right. Thank you for that question, and thank you for listening. The next question comes from Benito, who asks, oh, boy, I'm going to have a sip of my drink before I answer this one. Oh, boy. All right, here we go. Dear Suburban Shaman, can you tell us, please, how you feel about transgender people and people who have sex changes? Are these people mentally ill? Is it part of the Luciferian agenda to break up and destroy society? We argue about this a lot at home. Also, Is it fair for men who become women to enter sporting events? We are not prejudiced. We just want to learn more. Oof. This question, it comes up quite a bit in classes, and we're happy to address it, of course. We've chosen not to address it in public until, well, I guess today. So I read it out, so let's address it. And we'll have to break up the question into a few parts. So transgender, if by that you mean denoting or relating to a person whose sense of personal identity and gender does not correspond with their birth sex, their physical inventory. I can't tell you how I feel about it because I'm not aware that I feel anything in particular. It's none of my business how people identify. But as a shaman, I will just offer this. And I ask you all not to be triggered. I try to be as articulate as possible because I genuinely have no judgment on this. These are all new experiences and we're all working through it together. Incarnations are about having varied experiences. So say, for example, you've had multiple incarnations as a man, but very few as a woman. At some point, you will choose to balance that out and incarnate as a female. Now, after so many male incarnations, being female may feel unfamiliar and perhaps a touch uncomfortable. You might revert to more familiar masculine affectations. You might even find yourself attracted to other females instead of the opposite sex. And, you know, you see this quite a bit in the gay community. Please don't accuse me of prejudice. I am gay. Okay. You know, you see overly masculine women and you see overly camp feminine men. And you wonder why. And from a shaman's point of view, that's why. Now, if we understood how the world worked and how we choose our pre-birth agreements, soul contracts, genders, etc., would we behave differently if we knew the details and purpose of our incarnations? I believe it would make a difference. If we knew we came down to experience and explore a specific gender to get the most out of it, to really understand it, to inhabit it, I think we would be more comfortable in those bodies. And when we're more comfortable, chances are others would be too, and it might not be so much of an issue whether you're gay or transgender. Now, Benito, does it make you mentally ill? God, I hope not. In itself, no, of course not. But there are challenges associated with living life outside societal norms, and if one can't cope with those challenges, depression and other types of mental illness are possible. But is one mentally ill simply for being at odds with one's physical inventory? I think not. Now, people who go ahead and have the sex change, and again, I make no judgment on this, but I would ask that you think long and hard and get proper counseling before making the final decision and ask yourself why you chose to incarnate into a body that makes you so very uncomfortable. Do you understand that you had the choice of the incarnation? I have no choice but to approach it from a shaman's point of view. So, you know, perhaps there is a perfectly good reason. Perhaps you chose to do this to introduce a new experience to the collective consciousness. And if that's the case, well, golly, that's very brave of you to do so. And perhaps you made a really bad choice pre-birth. You made the wrong choice in gender. And what a blessing it must be for you to have the means to rectify that mistake. But I ask simply this, that you take every step possible to make sure that it is a mistake that needs to be rectified before the hormones and the surgery. And for any men out there who decide that they want to change their gender to a woman and you're still working age, I hope you enjoy being marginalized and ignored in the corporate world. I'm a woman. I love being a woman. I was born a woman. I want to stay a woman. I want to die a woman. But let me tell you something about hormones, female hormones. It's not something to take lightly. Okay, joking aside, you also asked, is it a Luciferian agenda to break up society? So you're asking me, is accepting transgenderism, is that part of a Luciferian agenda to break up society? I'll just go ahead and say what I have to say, because as always, I have no control how my words are received. But no, I don't think that you are a Luciferian if you're having gender issues, clearly. But that said, blurring the lines between gender has been on the establishment list of how to F things up for some time now, along with normalizing pedophilia, which is also part of that agenda, and just in general, blurring the lines on anything is a favorite establishment tool, and it affects every layer of our society. So this is something that we have to have more discussion about. You know, I have clients who are transgender. I have clients who don't associate with any gender. They might have been born male or female, but they believe that they're androgynous. This is clearly interesting to me. Society is changing. People used to be couples. Now there's even something called thruples. Again, no judgment. Three people in a relationship sounds like a nightmare to me, but apparently, you know, brave new world, things are changing. And you ask one more thing, Benito, what did you ask? Oh, you asked sporting events. I don't know enough to comment, but as a point of common sense, I suppose, if switching genders gives you an unfair physical advantage in sports, then of course you should not be allowed to participate. You know, I'll do some more research on that for my own general knowledge. I have a couple of friends who are doctors. But it's all about unfair advantage. So, you know, that's my response to that. So I want to thank you for bringing that up, Benito, because this is something that triggers a lot of people. And more discussion on that ahead, I suspect. And I do hope that it is discussion. Okay. And one more question, I think, or maybe not. Just keep going until we run out of time, I guess. Dear Ani, you talk about objectivity, but you have a lot of opinions. How do you reconcile the two? Gosh, that's a strange little question, isn't it? Perhaps we have different definitions of objectivity. It doesn't mean floating ideas around in your head and not doing anything with them. When you go into a restaurant, for example, and you are given a menu, do you just sit there reading the selections over and over again and until you go into a trance and eventually die from starvation? Probably not. Objectivity, it means a lack of bias, doesn't it? A lack of bias, judgment, or prejudice. It means I think with my divine mind and not through the filter of some conditioning or another, and we're all conditioned. But it doesn't mean I won't reach a conclusion. And it doesn't mean I won't change my mind when presented with new information to research. So I think perhaps you didn't quite understand what objectivity is there. But thank you for the question. Objectivity, neutrality, thinking beyond the filter of social, cultural, and partisan conditioning. It's very important. It's what's going to, you know, bring us into this brand new golden age. And I think we have time for one more question. And let's pick one, Ani, pick one. Don't pick anything too complicated. Yes, okay. This question is from Suzanne in Los Angeles. Hello, Suzanne in Los Angeles. I lived in Los Angeles when I first came to the States. I live somewhere much quieter now, and I'm very happy about that. Dear Ani, I want to find a spiritual community I resonate with, but so far, so bad. I have visited all the New Thought churches in my area. They are polite, well-meaning folks, but I don't feel the spirit. I don't feel the spirit move through me. I'm into social justice and that. I understand deeds, not creeds, and the need to get involved and to make a difference, but I cannot find a spiritual community to call home. The spark is missing. Do you have any suggestions? Well, Suzanne, in my capacity as objective shaman and fan of comparative religion, I have attended, I kid you not, thousands of services, and never came across the one place that I could call home. With New Thought churches, more than the other churches, the right minister makes a huge difference. And while I understand, believe me, I do, why people walk away from traditional religion, it's incomplete, it's immature, it's sanctimonious and often dangerous, the ancient right churches, but they have that sense of magic, of wonder and mysticism that modern churches do not. The music, the incense, the chanting, they're all designed to inspire and to take us to a place way beyond our mundane daily routines. And in those churches, for me anyway, the sermons, they're irrelevant. It's the sense of awe and wonder that's transmitted through the frankincense and the chants and the candles and the exotic vestments. That just, oh, that's what does it for me. That's the spirit flowing through me. Because in such an environment, we don't need or want a lecture on social justice. We want a personal connection to the divine mysteries. That's the spark that's missing. That connection with spirit, that direct knowing that we are so much more than anyone on earth would have us believe. The music, the fragrance, it shatters the illusion of separation between dimensions. We quite literally inhale the Holy Spirit, allowing it to saturate every nanocell of our being, restoring our optimal spiritual and physical health templates to the original perfection codes. In such an environment, we can see through space and time. The old rites, they knew how to create the magic. Unfortunately, they also know how to create the mayhem. So my suggestion is this. Until you find a place you can call base camp, explore beyond the New Thought churches. There's a lot of talking in New Thought services, a bit too much for my liking. Sometimes we need to be still and hear the voice of the divine, which is not necessarily the same as the voice of the pastor. So get the Yellow Pages for your part of Los Angeles and visit a new church each week. Each one will give you a new experience. Each one will have something to offer. Each one will touch a different part of your soul. You might find you prefer attending a mix and match selection anyway. And even if you find base camp, which I hope you do, it's not a bad idea to attend a different type of service every so often to shake things up. So I want to thank you for your question and thank everyone for all the questions. Keep them coming and let's keep the conversation going. All right, a little sip of my drinky poo. Right, that's it for Q&A today. It's time to announce the winner of last week's, it wasn't last week, it was 2 weeks ago, but it's time to announce the winner of the last show's Identify the Author contest. And I try to make it as difficult as possible in this age of Google knows everything. And I did very well with that last time, as only one person came up with the correct answer. That person was Jill in Beaverton, Oregon, who correctly identified the very obscure text from the Lamentations of Narek by Gregory of Narek, an Armenian mysticist, lyrical poet, monk, and theologian, a man who did angst better than anyone else. So well done to Jill, who receives a $40 gift certificate to any of my services. Oh, joy and jubilation to you, Jill. What could be better? And now, my darlings, it's time for the Wizard's Gizzard. And I've got a new little toy. That's a kazoo. It's a cheap sound effect. So, whiz-giz, a little spiritual ritual that you can make habitual. Today's ritual is taken from my 1001 Preparatory Exercises for Astral Travel. I don't actually have 1001 preparatory exercises for astral travel, but for those who study with me, it sometimes feel like it, because if I'm sending you on a cosmic journey, it's my duty to make sure you know how to get out of trouble if you take a wrong turn. So this is a very simple little exercise, and you don't have to be interested in astral travel to do it. It's just part of your general awareness. Astral travel? It's easy peasy lemon squeezy, but only after you master the prep exercises. So, take 3 slow, deep, purposeful breaths. Visualize your aura loosely around you, egg-shaped, bright white, extending under your feet. Eyes open. Look at your hands, palm up towards your face for about 30 seconds. Rotate your wrists if you want, but then return your hands to the palm up position. Now, palms up still, look at your left hand and examine it carefully for a few seconds. Now focus on your thumb. Spend a few seconds focusing on your thumb. Bend it. Stretch it out again. Go to the first finger. Examine the first finger. Bend it. Straighten it out again. Go to the next finger. Bend it. Straighten it out again. And I think you get the picture. You do this to all the fingers of the left hand. And then you repeat that exercise, starting with the thumb on the right hand. And now you look at your feet for about 30 seconds. Best if you can do this with bare feet, of course. Wiggle your toes, rotate your ankles, whatever feels good. Just look at your feet. Now look at your left foot. Examine it for about 30 seconds. When you have a lovely sense of your left foot, look at your big toe. If you can move it, many of us cannot move our toes individually, but if you can move it, do so. Just move it. Raise it, and then relax it. If you can't move it, pretend you're moving it. Now do the same with all the toes. Second, third, fourth, and pinky toe. Taking your time, I know we're doing this a little faster than we normally would today. And when you've gone down and you've done the left foot, go to your right foot and starting with the big toe, raise the toe and relax it. Moving to the second toe, relax it. Third toe, relax it. Fourth toe, relax it. Pinky toe and relax it. And when you're done, take 3 more deep, slow, purposeful breaths. And when you feel ready, touch the thymus gland and say, I am as perfect as the moment of my creation. And get on with your day. And you may say, gosh, Ani, that's a very silly exercise. Most of the exercises in metaphysics are very, very simple. It's the persistence and diligence and focus and the repetition that prepare you to do what you would consider the more complex things of projecting astrally or even projecting your physical body through time and space. This is very 101 basic stuff, but a very good building block for general awareness. And there are many more parts to this. This is only the first part of about 10 parts. So if you're interested in exploring them, drop me a line and I'll give you an overview of what it's all about. You see, people say, well, I want to hurtle through time and space, Ani. Well, I want to take my astral body and I want to go and I want to visit the world. Fantastic, I support you in that. But if you don't have a sense of your physical body, there's no point in you trying to project your astral body. All right. Well, that's it for the whiz-giz. I think it's time for a little pat of poetry. Yes, folks, after a hard day's shamaning, I like nothing better than coming home, putting my feet up, having a nice cup of tea or a small drinky poo, and writing really bad, non-peer-reviewed poetry. Why have Rudyard Kipling and literary prowess when you can have me, Cosmic Arnie, and a whole lot less? Today's poem is from my best-selling, record-breaking culinary anthology, Foods That Should Never Have Made It to the Table. And this is inspired from when I was a young girl at boarding school. We learnt Latin, and we knew, you know, they told us stories about ancient Rome and the Roman soldiers, and, oh, it was just such an exciting adventure they were on. And I was obsessed with Rome and Roman soldiers and all of that. So today's selection, an original work by yours truly, titled, I Wonder Why the Romans Decided to Eat Snails. Thank you very much. I wonder why the Romans decided to eat snails. They are gooey and disgusting, and they leave slimy trails. What level of hunger must they have experienced to test to the maximum limit their gastric resilience? I can understand beef. There's much meat on a cow. Throw in onions and carrots, and you've got some lovely chow. I can understand pigeons and chickens and game. But to be stuck with a dish of snails, that's a crying shame. Marching briskly all the day, as Roman soldiers do, wondering if the snail will wriggle out when they have their morning poo. Those boys deserved roast lamb smothered in honey from the Roman gods. But all they got instead was a gelatinous gastropod. Well, that was it, folks. Original poetry from me. I wonder why the Romans decided to eat snails. I've eaten snails. They're inedible. Unless they're bathed in garlic and it's the last food group in the world. All right. Where are we now? Yes, it's time for Tarot a Go Go. A little shenanigana with the Major Arcana. Using the Rider-Waite deck. And on our last show, we featured the Hanged Man, number 12. So this week we feature number 13, Death, the Death card. The look on people's faces when we pull this card is actually quite precious. So let's take a look and see what we have. We have a skeletal figure in black armor riding a white horse. And the horse has red eyes for that extra Hollywood spooky effect. And Death, he holds a black banner, numbered 13, with the emblem of a white bloom on it. So white and white blooms have so many meanings. But in this case, it is the purity of the eternal form. The end of one form means the beginning of a new form. Arthur Waite from, you know, Rider Waite, called it the Mystic Rose. So this horse with death on it, he seems to be walking over people, doesn't he, in various stages of their personal drama. There's a high-ranking cleric there who seems to be pleading with death. The symbolism is that really death is... Well, it's the great equalizer. There's a fertile field behind him. There's young people. Everybody, nobody escapes death, I think, is the message here. But please don't panic when you get this card, because it doesn't mean you're going to drop dead. Well, at least we hope it's not. I mean, it can, when matched with certain other cards. It can portend death, but on its own, it usually just is a card of transition. It could be a mystical death, a death of one level of consciousness and entry into a higher level of awareness. Either way, it's a profound change. a necessary change, often a liberating change. Rebirth and renewal. You know, with the death card, it's never a subtle change. Advancement, well, we all know spiritual advancement, it's not a bed of roses, is it? It's often a painful process. The old ego kicks and screams, begging for more life. And sometimes we have to beat it over the head and kick and scream back until it dies. The death card says, look, child, the old ways no longer serve us. It is time to move on. And if we pick this card reversed, it's a warning. It says, look, you are resisting necessary change. You are being stubborn. You are stuck in the past, locked in fear, holding up not only your soul contracts and pre-birth agreements, but those of others. If you can't move on, they will have to break their contracts with you and others, and that could start a chain of woe while everyone renegotiates, and quite possibly without you. Don't miss out on a good opportunity. This card, upright or reversed, reminds us that it's not wise to get too comfortable in any location or in any situation. In the blink of an eye, everything can change. Enjoyment of the physical is what we came down for, and we should enjoy it, but attachment to the physical, that ruins the game. 13, the death card. And a reminder from me that although tarot is something that requires dutiful study and practice, I mean, you can't just buy a deck, open up a Celtic spread, and read what the book says. I mean, you can. It's up to you. I'm not a control freak, but you won't get much out of it that way. When you buy a deck of tarot cards, and please don't buy something really obscure, just buy something fairly traditional for your first set. Take them out of the box, wrap them in a silk cloth, shuffle them for 30 minutes every day for 33 days, and sleep with them under your pillow. Show them a good time. Infuse them with your energy. Bond with them. If you really want to take things seriously, wash your hands before you shuffle them, you know? Then pick a card a day and spend about 15 minutes with it. Examine it. Just look at it. Be with it. Don't examine it like an analyst. Just look at it and go, what's this card all about? There's a bloke. He's dead. He's wearing armor. He's on a white horse. The horse has got red eyes. Well, people are strewn about the bodies. Just look at it. That's all. That kind of examination. What do the symbols mean to you? What do the symbols mean to you? They meant something to the people who illustrated them, but symbolism is culture specific. You know, a red chicken means something specific to a Chinese person, and it means something completely different to a British person. So what do the symbols mean to you? That's more important than what the guidebook says it means. The guidebook will give you instruction on the basics, but tarot cards, when they are loved and touched daily, they come to life in our hands. The characters on the cards, they will, after a while, quite literally come to life and talk to you. And they will give you advice. Tarot cards encourage creative visualization, without which, by the way, we could not have co-created the cosmos. Number 13, death. What is it all about? All right. Enjoy your tarot cards, my darlings. And coming up to April, May, June, July, August, September, I do all of my classes, basic 101 classes on energy work and on home and property clearing, tea and tarot, one of the most popular, one of the most loved little workshops that we do, where we explain the basics of tarot and how to use it for your personal creative visualization and advancement of your soul. So I'll be posting those on the website in another month or so. For those of you who are interested in what I get up to when I'm not doing this show, please visit my website, arnieavedisyan.com, and all shall be revealed. If you would like to sign up for my monthly newsletter, Monday Messages, it's short, it's sweet, it's full of buttery goodness, and it will give you a heads up on what I'm going, you know, to do with regard to classes, etc. Not everything is posted on the website. It's usually on the newsletter first, and then it's on the website. I also post a lot of specials on my newsletter that never get posted on the website, so that's worth a shot. Also, if you go to YouTube and put in my name, Arnie Avedisyan, all of my short instructional and, if I may say so, quite fabulous videos on metaphysics and spirituality will come up. There's about 105 of those. So enjoy, like, subscribe, share, whatever the heck you want to do. And in addition to Metaphysical Martini, which goes out every other Wednesday, I have the pleasure of co-hosting the Say What Show with Fancy Nancy Hopkins and Jolly Dolly Howard on the second Saturday of each month. So there's a lot to be going on with, and I see that we're coming very close to the end of the hour. So I will then say, my darlings, we will leave the philosophy section for next time, and we're going to be studying Epicurus next time. He's just a lovely chap and very misunderstood. But as we come up to the top of the hour, I think that's it for this week. I have finished my drink, and that means it's the end of the show. So, you know, I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed presenting it, because I had a blast. Today's real life martini was actually club soda on the rocks with a squeeze of lemon, because I am still on a diet. But I promise the distilleries of the world I will be back sampling and promoting your products in the not too distant future. Something I do by my own volition, and I'm not recompensed in any way by anyone. However, if you would like to discuss sponsorship, I'm all ears. And if we're talking a decent amount of dosh, I'm sure your brand of vodka or gin will be my favorite for as long as we hang out together. Friends, a reminder that cocktails are great if they are an occasional treat. If you use the best possible ingredients and take the art of mixology seriously, one drink is all you need. I'm Arnie Avedisyan. This was Metaphysical Martini, a production of Cosmic Reality Radio, to whom we are most grateful. Until we meet again, let the spirit inhabit the human.
You have been listening to the Metaphysical Martini Show with Arnie Avedisyan, the Suburban Shaman, a production of Cosmic Reality Radio.